Well, we arrive at the climax of Esther. We see the outcome and how it all goes down. So today, we're going to observe a spectacular deliverance account. If you'd say you're a Christian, it will help us to be grateful of our own rescue and deliverance. And if you're still working out what Christianity means for you, you'll get to see God's might and preciousness of his people to him, which in turn I hope will allow you to begin to realize the depths of the love, care, and rescue that God offers you as well. So the story so far, a people in a perilous situation. Just a few short chapters ago, the Jews were in a seemingly impossible position to get out. Haman, a hater of Mordecai, channels his hatred into a plan to exterminate Mordecai's entire race with all the power and the resources to him to make that happen. The dice, the purr, had been rolled. The lot had cast the certain end of God's people. This was worse than the predicament of the Passover of slavery in Egypt, and seemingly worse than the very exile the Jews found themselves in. The shadow of death, extermination, in fact, had never loomed so large for the Jews. It's imminent. Long gone are the glory years of the Jewish Davidic kingdom of self-rule and world fame. We're toward the end of the Old Testament now, and we find the Jews in much darker times. Even in all the humour we've had, and it's fun, I'm going to see some more, it's really serious. Yet an astonishing undoing comes through the wisdom of one man and one queen. With the backdrop of an ever-increasing list of it-just-so-happens situations, those coincidences, a couple placed, at just the right time, in just the right place, to bring about the impossible moment, all coming together for a miraculous plot twist, an unbelievable reversal, the saving of many. Then, unexpectedly, a way out is pronounced. So as we join the story, the 13th day, that day of Adar, hasn't arrived yet. The new edict, granting the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, has been written and sent out via the empire's fastest and most secure delivery system. But which one is going to win out? What is going to happen? Haman is gone, but the edict is irrevocable. Thanks to the Aladdin-like Sultan for the law of the Persians and the Medes, no decree or edict the king issues can be changed. Can't even change his own word. But will Haman, by way of the decree devised, still actually gain the victory from beyond the grave? Reverse the reversal that we've seen. Can it actually end up getting the last laugh? The thing that was missed? Let's pick up the story and see how it ends. Reading from chapter 8, verse 15 there, as we come out of the king's palace. Mordecai left the king's presence wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold and purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and in every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating. And many of the other nationalities became Jews because a fear of the Jews had seized them. So Mordecai leaves more elevated than Haman, and the Jews enjoy a time of happiness, joy, gladness, and honor. It's a stark contrast to the first edict in 4:3 that brought fasting, weeping, wailing, sackcloth and ashes. Rather than a pitied people, the Jew become those that you want to be. But what about the 13th day? Is all this a bit of a last hurrah? Or a kind of a desperate last grasp for sort of survival? Well, let's read it. Esther 9:1. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews, who had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. This is the moment when you stand and applaud. When you're at that play, the crowd would erupt. What a turnaround. We see a reversal declared here. The tables are turned on their enemies. Surprisingly, though, the playing field is not just simply even, as if they kind of just scraped their way to a close victory. This is a triumph. This is a triumphant reversal. So what did the day the tables turn look like? Well, this reversal is now what we see described. So let's read on. Verse 2. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them because the people of other nations were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews, because a fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. The Jews struck down all their enemies with a sword, killing and destroying them, and they did whatever they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed Parshan Dathan, Dalthon, Ashpatha, Porotha, Adaliah, Aradatha, Paramashatha, Aradiah, and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, sons of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. They didn't lay the hand on the plunder. The number of those slain in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. The king said to Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's province? Now, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What's your request? It will be granted. Wow. A reversal described there. No one could stand against them. They get help, enemy struck down, 500 killed in the citadel, and 10 sons put to death. And that's just the first part. We're going to read more in a minute. But let's unpack the significance of the reversal that's described in this first part of the story. No one could stand against them. The fear of the Jews, as we saw before, means other nations don't want to rise up against them. Now, this fear that seizes the Persian Empire here is more, I think, than just kind of having the king's backing here. I think it throws us back, actually, to the bigger story of the Jews when other nations heard of God's action, especially in defeating the Egyptians and delivering his people in the predicament of slavery in Exodus. When other nations heard about that, like Rahab says in Joshua, our hearts melted in fear and everyone's courage failed. like Rahab and her support of the spies, to fear and respect the Jews is actually in some measure to fear and respect their God. And it throws us to what the prophets have said in the Old Testament about the promises that all nations will one day come to know God, to fear him as they see his acts. And so I think it throws you and I forward a bit to the response of others when they hear of God's greatest deliverance in Jesus, yeah? Right in the thick and the beginning of the news going out to the ends of the earth, what do we hear in Acts? When this became known to the Jews and the Greeks living in Ephesus, they were all seized with fear, and the name of the Lord, was Lord Jesus, was held in high honor. Now, as we consider our now, I think to begin to take Christians seriously, to begin to respect their message and appreciate a Christian's life choices, is to begin to do likewise, to take God more seriously. That is to fear him and move toward him. Because as people, perhaps yourself or your classmates at UTAS, become aware of God's deliverance he has brought, the dealings with us that shuffles priorities and kind of gives a different perspective on ourselves and what matters, it may very well start to cause many to fear God and join those in such a triumphant position. So next there, the Jews get high power support in verse 3. Well, why? Well, because Mordecai's presence and power increases. The empire's administration, political leaders, and just generally key kind of society figures all get behind the Jewish cause. That's amazing. And there in verse 5, their enemies are killed and destroyed, and they have freedom to do as they please to those who hated them. From that, we see there are still those who rise up and go for them, but they are put down. Not only that, but amazingly, permission is given to take on any tactics and dealings with the enemies that they like. The only rule that applies is no rules apply. That's crazy. The Jews, of course, weren't permitted to kill at random. They only attacked those who suited up, armed up, and attacked them. They're measured. They don't go on a vengeful killing spree. And this moves them on this day from the back foot to the front foot. And then we see 500 people are killed in the citadel of Susa in verse 6. Now, that number signals the reality that there was a lot of influential people in the highest levels of admin and the ruling area, that kind of hub of the empire that were working against the Jews. So it wasn't just a handful of slightly annoyed, grumpy people that were on board with Haman. It was 500 people that held a lot of power. The sons of Haman are killed in 7 to 10. Haman has lost his life, his position, his property, and now the final and catastrophic blow falls, his family line. And this marks his total reversal. What's more, it signals the defeat of Israel's age-old enemy, I think. Not just the kind of villain of this story. Give me a boo, Haman. Stumpy feet. Yeah, do the boo again, because that was rubbish. Yeah, stumpy feet, because it was rubbish. There we go. That will make sense to some and seem very weird to others. Now, did you notice the phrase that the Jews, the phrase there that comes up? The Jews did not lay their hand on the plunder. And this is going to be repeated in the next bit. It's kind of a flashing neon sign telling us that this is important information. But why? Why is it significant? Well, the Amalekites, stay with me, And God's people had a history. As Israel was making its way out of Egypt after their deliverance, the Amalekites were the first nation to attack them unprovoked. And this led to God's commitment to wipe out the memory of them. So hold that thought. Haman was an Agite, the descendant of King Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites in the time of Saul. Saul, the Jews' first king, was given the role to execute God's judgment on the Amalekites. But he failed to do this properly and took the one thing that God had explicitly told them not to take, the plunder. And interestingly, guess who Mordecai is a descendant of? Saul. Look at it in 2:5. There was unresolved business. Perhaps you get now why he absolutely refused to bow to Haman, yeah? I think the reason the Jews are not taking the plunder in this instance is that they're doing this to reverse the sin of Saul. They're not failing in their chance to properly deal with enemies, Israel's age-old enemy. It's really cool. And the death of Haman's son, I think, symbolizes in some way the utter defeat of that Amalekites and the final erasing of the Amalekites' names. We have a moment here where the Jews' age-old enemy, who had the upper hand and is about to totally overthrow them, are instead overturned themselves. They experience the fulfillment of God's promise of judgment. What a victory. This is another thing that he's at work doing, isn't it? The defeat of the enemy of the Jews may be their greatest. At least one right that got at them and tried to take them out of their infancy. God's choosing them and making them a people, his people. I think it has something maybe to say to you and I. Just talking, if I can for a second, for those who would identify as a Christian. This bigger story thread, I think, weaved into Esther here, points to the truth that God, in the end, at the right time, will right wrongs and properly deal with those who set themselves up as enemies of Christianity or of you personally. Whether that comes from those who are bent on our destruction in one way or another, or that which is just not flesh and blood that operates behind the scenes. God will, in time, even down to what might be the wire that day of judgment, like those who Haman stands for, he will blot out their memory from under heaven. So take the comfort when gospel injustices, prejudices, and the pain of all of that comes our way. Yeah? So let's read on, because there's more. Verse 13, if it pleases the king, Esther answered, give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on gallows. So the king commanded this to be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they hanged the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's province also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but did not lay their hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th they rested and made it a day of fasting, feasting, and joy. That's an error. So we go on to see more of the reversal described, don't we? Another day, verse 14. I actually never saw that coming. The time needed is extended to defend against and defeat the Jewish enemies. They get 2 days. The enemy got one. It's doubled the amount. The sons of Haman are put on a pole, and this serves an example and a vivid picture of the empire's position toward the enemies of the Jews. It says, "You stand against us, and you will become like this." And 75,000 in verse 16 are killed. That's astonishing. And clearly, the Jewish enemies were actually substantial enough to indeed wipe them out, weren't they? That is big. But they meet their end, whether they were Amalekites or not. What a day or two across the empire. None of this is just a simple reversal, is it? And then this leads us to verse 17. They rested. They rested. Let those words soak in. Rest. God's people now experience a touch of what has always been Israel's goal. Rest from their enemies. What has been experienced in the past, but has been lost, is now in part wonderfully recovered. They experience in that rest a glimpse of what will be experienced in full colour when God comes to dwell with his people and will be with them. And tears and death, and all in the old order, will be gone as everything will be made new. Death, tears, suffering, grief, loneliness, bitterness, vengeance, struggle, all done with. Rest. The reversal described here is nothing short of comprehensive, is it? No one could stand against them, just about sums it up. It's not a simple reversal. This is a triumph. The tables were turned, and it turned the Persian Empire, the world, upside down with it. It's a great story. It's a great history. But why? Because in the background is the sovereign work of God. We've heard a lot about that this week, haven't we? That you see across the whole story. God's unfolding story of salvation is at play. In the good and the bad and the ambiguous, he is ordering with, without, and despite the characters here and the powers that be, to protect and bring about his great promise. God's commitment to his special promise to his people back in Genesis 12 is absolute and unstoppable. God is one who overturns and turns around everything to bring about his plans and assure his deliverance. He will even rend the heavens and come down, won't he? Like those in Esther, you don't have to see God in the foreground to see him displayed. Even feel him and even be clear in kind of any measure about precisely like what is he up to. But to know, to trust in the background, he is powerfully acting, deeply concerned, and actually spectacularly at work for his glory and for your good in all things. In all things, they are working together. Unifellowship, you need to see mystery in your life as good. To sit with it and accept it as a normal and worthy way that God works. However random and chaotic and confusing timetables might be, however things might appear to you. Is that what you believe? And have you connected Jesus really is the ultimate evidence for that? The triumphant reversal has been declared. It's been described. And now, it is the magnitude of this triumph that means this reversal, it must be celebrated. It must be remembered. Mordecai recorded these events and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joying and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. A reversal is celebrated here. In this last section, we see the establishment of the festival of Purim. And this reversal is celebrated. This event is now to be marked in the Jewish calendars across the whole empire for generations to come. Far from wiping out the Jews, Haman set off a series of events that enshrined Jewish victory in history and created a celebration across the 127 provinces. It's brilliant. And people come from around the world to see the celebration to this day. It's hilarious. You see, God won't be mocked, will he? So the Jews agree to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agai, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and cast the Pur, that is, the lot, for their ruin and their destruction. Verse 28, those days of Purim should never cease to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of them die out among their descendants. And the name of the festival? How the cast of the die fell. I needn't say any more. It's great. Purim then, as today for the Jews, as verse 22 says, it's all about the time when the Jews got their relief from their enemy, and the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. And this celebration is an appropriate response to the Jewish predicament, their deliverance and their triumph, isn't it? It isn't a time of lament. That would just be well off the mark. That'd be a ridiculous thing for a Jew to do, yeah? So today, a bit of what Mikey said, for those who didn't catch it, the Jewish Purim Guide, I got it off the guide for what's going on this year. It's on the 20th of March, by the way, which is really interesting. So this day drops in a month. So children and adults dress in costumes, and they put like a masquerade party on. They read Esther. They make sure they dress up as like Esther and Mordecai. And make themselves kind of happy and joyful. And it says here, all to kind of tell the story, but also an allusion to God's hand in the Purim miracle, which was disguised by natural events. How beautiful. When Haman's name is mentioned, you boo, and you stamp your feet to eradicate his name, and you twirl like those things around. You give to the needy. And you've got to find at least two people less fortunate than you to give money to or food. And you emphasize the importance of friendship as well and the kind of community by sending gifts or food to friends. And the celebratory meal itself is just full of singing, of drinking, of laughing, and just having fun together. Apparently, that is the Purim spirit. Isn't that cool? And isn't celebration what those who have known God's salvation always do? when Israel has done in the Psalms, did with Deborah in Thanksgiving in Judges, before that with Joshua's victory over Jericho and Ai, and then before that with the Passover as Moses led them in that song of praise to God for their deliverance. You see, what you value, you will celebrate. And what you celebrate, you will value. Isn't that the case? And I just ask you, what do you celebrate if you identify as a Christian in your faith? And if you wouldn't, what do you celebrate? Why do you value that? Our values in our loves, in our local churches, and in our society will be seen, won't it, in what we talk about all the time, what thrills us, what we come back to in song, what we promote, and just what the main things are that actually move us to joy and gladness and send us away from sorrow and mourning. So Pernem is established. Yet the reversal declared, the reversal described, and the reversal celebrated does sit kind of a little uncomfortable as we read the story's ending. It brings us to reconsider the reversal and its true extent. So chapter 10, King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores. And all his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king had raised him, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of the Medes and Persians? Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews and held in high esteem by his many fellows, Jewish fellows, because he worked for the good of his people. He spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. We are left with the reality of the Jewish people. The end is not meant to take away from the celebration, but it does bring us back to the context, doesn't it? It shows us that the Jews are still a conquered nation. That's what verse 1 is getting at with the tribute. Triumphant, yes, but conquered. And so the Jews are left looking for and hoping for a time when a bigger, a better, a worldwide, a more permanent reversal takes place, aren't they? A turning of the tables par excellence, when God will fully and finally bring his promises to reality. Along with the Jews, we leave Esther waiting and watching for when at just the right time, one will be raised up who wouldn't be in the line of Saul, but in David. Who wouldn't just be wise, but perhaps wisdom himself. Whose power, influence, and kindness is enough to rescue his people from the strongest of foes. Someone to stand and speak out in a way that cares for the deepest and most needed welfare of people. It is when one comes to his own who don't recognize him or receive him, the Jews and all people, a declaration is made by this person. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? The time has come. A day is approaching. The hour has dawned. The cross is that astonishing moment when at just the right time, Jesus brings the greatest deliverance. The one raised up and sent for a time just as this, the saving of many. Yet it's not only what happened on the first day or the second day, but the third day. Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Then Simon later declares the triumph of this reversal. Men of Israel, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. This man was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him up from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of the fact, exalted to the right hand of God. You see, the resurrection is the day when the tables were turned on humanity's enemies. The dice had been rolled by our sin, the world and the devil, and cast our certain death and judgment. This victory over our greatest enemies has been won by actions that go beyond our own efforts. Through faith, we share in the resurrection life and experience this triumphant reversal that Jesus brings. You don't simply scrape through. You are saved. You are raised. And you are elevated to reign with Christ. And one day you will know the full reality of that. Uni Fellowship, the magnitude of this is astonishing. You see, Paul, talking about the resurrection, says this: when the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true: death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your sting? Where, O death, is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. That's what the resurrection does. And I start to see a humor in that. In the way God has so undone death that it dies. Death dying through the reversal of the sting itself had struck the Son with. That death of the Son then brings life out of death. That's hilarious. It's brilliant. It's the resurrection. And it's got to be the most beautiful irony ever. Death dies. That's what Jesus risen does. And because of him, that's what our resurrection will do as well. It was an impossible situation we found ourselves in, and you might still find yourself in. The resurrection leaves you and I with the spontaneous and the ongoing celebration of the joy and gladness of finding ourselves able to stand. Stand before God after a just, irrevocable death decree was set to be executed, and had in fact already been put in motion as the wrath of God was revealed. And Uni Fellowship, this is the message that we get to take to UTAS, to our classmates, and to our world. A message of triumphant reversal, one that will turn lives upside down, will turn UTAS upside down, because God has turned the tables on his enemies, hasn't he? And it moves us to celebrate this reversal. It causes you and I to become permanent people, permanently, to live that, not occasionally. Is a state of joyful celebration what we live in? We're not in heaven enjoying resurrection bodies yet, but we're on the road there. The victory is won, and we're heading to the after party. You see, the triumph of the resurrection means that the Christian life isn't always one that is serious and sober and solemn. We've got to watch how much we fill our Christian gatherings, our communions, and our conversations with this kind of attitude. They can't always be grave, weighty, quiet, and reflective. That kind of Christian community perhaps hasn't quite really appreciated their resurrection and the appropriate response to it. Remember, Purim is about the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. How much more so us, guys? So like the end of Esther, our current time and our current place reminds us that the final resurrection day hasn't arrived yet, hey? We're left waiting, enjoying the first fruits of the resurrection, rejoicing in the triumphal reversal that has taken place, and trusting God's mysterious and sovereign work through and despite us in turning upside down those close to us and turning upside down the lives of people far from us that goes far beyond the 127 providences now, hey? And will. Because God in Jesus Christ has turned the table.